Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Wednesday, the 4th of September. Our main stories. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson loses his majority in Parliament and suffers a stinging defeat over Brexit, raising the prospect of a snap general election. After battering the Bahamas for a whole day, Hurricane Dorian has finally begun to move on, heading towards the US, but the scale of the damage is not yet known. And why the tsunami threat of an Indonesian volcano is far greater than previously feared. Also in this podcast, a huge blast in Kabul kills innocent civilians just as a draft peace deal is announced with the Taliban.
This explosion shattered the evening, and this family alone lost three family members. So a terrible, terrible tragedy and terrible, terrible timing.
And could a local rap group help revive an ancient language in a small Colombian village?
Part of the group's mission, to use language, African instruments and stories about San Basilio de Palenque to help preserve the town's traditions.
More on that later. It has been a momentous day in British politics. In his first significant test as Prime Minister, Boris Johnson lost his majority and suffered a stinging defeat in his first major vote in Parliament.
The ayes to the right, 328. The noes to the left, 301.
Not a good start, Boris.
And that prompted a furious response from the Prime Minister. The MPs, including 21 in his own party, voted temporarily to take control of lawmaking from the government, an all but unprecedented step. The alliance of rebel conservatives and opposition parties wants to ensure that Mr Johnson can't engineer a no-deal Brexit. The Prime Minister says that is not his intention, and he is trying to negotiate a new agreement with the EU. But he says this defeat in Parliament will undermine his efforts. And if he were to be defeated again on Wednesday, he said he'd have no choice but to call a snap election.
I don't want an election, but if MPs vote tomorrow to stop negotiations and to compel another pointless delay to Brexit, potentially for years, then that would be the only way to resolve this.
The Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, said the vote showed the Prime Minister had to listen to MPs.
As I've said before, if the Prime Minister has the confidence in his Brexit policy, when he has one he can put forward, he should put it before the people in a public vote. And so, he wants to table a motion for a general election. Fine, get the bill through first in order.
Well, our political correspondent Rob Watson spent the day in Westminster. I asked him to put the vote in context.
I would say this. I think what it means is that an end to Britain's profound Brexit crisis is as uncertain as ever. I mean, you can get into much more detail than that, Oliver. Undoubtedly a momentous defeat for Boris Johnson, a bad start to his time as Prime Minister. Great uncertainty over what happens next. But, I mean, fundamentally, that is it. I mean, you've seen extraordinary divisions in the governing Conservative Party, people leaving, people being expelled, extraordinary speeches from formerly senior mainstream Conservatives. But fundamentally, that is it. I mean, it seems to me that we are as uncertain now as to how Britain's profound Brexit crisis ends than we've been before.
Yeah, and looking at the government, since those more hardline Brexiteers took control, they've been pretty robust. What's their likely response to this setback in Parliament?
Well, we already know that they want an election sooner rather than later, and that will be the next big battle in British politics. When would the election be, under what conditions? But it seems to me that Mr Johnson and those around him are all part of the Vote Leave campaign. They may have no choice but to accept the opposition party's conditions. That is, yes, you can have an election, but only after you've agreed a delay to Brexit.
And then, I mean, can an election resolve this?
Well, it's perfectly possible that it might not. I mean, let's imagine that you have an election and some Some opinion pollsters have crunched the numbers and, as they are now, think that you could end up with another party, another parliament where the Conservatives are the largest party, but not necessarily with a majority. And then you would go back to all the problems that we've seen over the last 3 years. And in the end, it really does come down to that essentially Britain's politicians still cannot decide what on earth to do about the result of the 2016 referendum. I mean, those who are on the side of Brexit can't agree on exactly what kind of Brexit they would like, and those people who wish that the vote had gone the other way in 2016, they can't decide what to do about it either. Should there be another referendum, a general election, a softer form of Brexit? I mean, the mess continues, and if anything, I think Oliver has deepened.
Rob Watson in Westminster. Well, the Prime Minister's also facing legal challenges over his decision to ask the Queen to prorogue or suspend Parliament for 5 weeks in the run-up to Brexit. The announcement last week was seen by some as a tactic to allow the government to force through a no-deal Brexit. But the government itself said it was purely routine. Scotland's highest civil court heard the case on Tuesday, and there'll be a similar hearing at the High Court in London on Wednesday. So what is the case against? I asked our legal affairs correspondent, Clive Coleman.
They're essentially arguing that the legal advice given by the Prime Minister to the Queen was given on an unlawful basis, and that the real reason for proroguing Parliament was to reduce the amount of parliamentary time that's available to MPs to scrutinise the various Brexit options. If any of them are successful in getting a ruling, that was indeed the case. That, I think, puts the Queen potentially into a difficult position because she would have made an order in council proroguing Parliament that would have been made on an unlawful basis. The government, of course, have said consistently through all of this, no, proroguing Parliament is a perfectly lawful practice. We know it is. It happens all the time. And in any event, basically, the government is saying this is politics and the courts don't really have the right to adjudicate in these matters, and effectively they should butt out.
I mean, what are the chances of success? We've got some pretty high-powered people, including a former Prime Minister, involved in the one in England.
Yes, I mean, the challenge that's being brought in the courts in England and Wales is being brought by Gina Miller, the businesswoman. Now, she famously brought a challenge against the government in relation to the triggering of the Article 50 process whereby the UK leaves the EU. The government had proposed to trigger that, again, using prerogative powers, just ministers doing it, and she effectively forced a vote in Parliament. And many people thought she would lose that case, but she didn't. She won it. And she's got the same crack legal team. She has Lord Panic, regarded by many as the most brilliant barrister practicing at the bar. What's really fascinating about that case is that they're essentially arguing that Boris Johnson's intent was unlawful. Now, that's difficult. How do you prove intent? People don't write down, you know, what I really intended was X, Y, Z. So you have to infer it from what evidence and information you do have. And that's why the intervention of a former Conservative Prime Minister, Sir John Major, who's today been given permission to intervene, make written submissions in this case. Of course, he's gone through this proroguing process himself. He's obviously looked at the constitutional law that underpins it, and he's given advice to the Queen. So that may be very powerful assistance to Gina Miller. On the other hand, in 1997, John Major himself was accused of political proroguing. When Parliament was prorogued, it was alleged at the time that it was done early in order to bury a report in what was called the Cash for Questions scandal. That was MPs who were accused of taking cash for asking questions in the Commons. So it's really set to be a kind of battle royal, if you'll excuse the slight pun that I just inserted there. But it's going to be a really fascinating legal battle at the High Court. All of these cases could end up at the UK's Supreme Court. So the challenge in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, there's a challenge in Scotland, the challenge in the England and Welsh courts. Depending on what progress they make, they could all end up early next week at the UK's Supreme Court, where the court would have the option to roll them all up into one and hear them as one.
The BBC's legal affairs correspondent, Clive Coleman. Other news now, and as if the people of Afghanistan needed a reminder of the turmoil facing their country, a huge bomb killed 16 people in the capital, Kabul, just as a US envoy announced a draft peace deal had been agreed with the Taliban. The militants themselves said they carried out the attack and they targeted foreign forces. The Afghan government says all the victims were civilians. Ejaz Malikzada, a researcher at the Afghan Institute for Strategic Studies in Kabul, felt the blast in his home.
I was just sitting with my family and my wife, and a huge sound of explosion, and then the windows shattered. My nephew started screaming and crying. As far as the Taliban are concerned, we can hear them in Doha, we can hear them in Facebook, we can hear them in media. They have not changed. They will keep bombing. They say we'll fight. Even if we sign an agreement with the Americans, we'll keep fighting and we'll kill no matter what. So the Taliban have not changed. The only change that I can see is their bombs have got bigger.
Ijaz Malik Zada. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, says the blast was terrible timing for the peace process.
That was just at the time where a family told us today that they were all sitting around next to the television in their home. The whole family, including the children, watching this interview with the U.S. envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, talking about how the United States had made a deal in principle with the Taliban about moving towards peace. And then this explosion shattered the evening, and this family alone lost 3 family members, and many others also lost as well. So a terrible, terrible tragedy and terrible, terrible timing.
Lise Doucette. So what does the attack mean for the prospects of peace and a US withdrawal? David Petraeus is a former US Army general and director of the CIA.
We went there for a reason, to ensure that the sanctuary in which Al-Qaeda planned the 9/11 attacks was eliminated, and we've stayed to ensure that it is not reestablished. And now, of course, the Islamic State is trying to do the same as Al-Qaeda. We've also stayed because this provides us a platform for the regional counterterrorism campaign. We would have to be very confident that Al-Qaeda cannot reestablish that sanctuary and that the Islamic State cannot do likewise. I have considerable reservations about such a commitment bearing out. I have considerable concern about the Taliban actually being able to implement what it is they apparently are promising to do relative to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. I also have grave reservations about what will happen if the Taliban decides to overthrow the Afghan government and reimpose the kind of medieval rule that they administered when they were last in charge of the country.
David Petraeus. In December last year, more than 400 people were killed when a tsunami hit coastal towns on Indonesia's Sunda Strait. There were no warnings of the giant waves that struck at night, destroying hundreds of homes, sweeping away cars and uprooting trees. The cause of the destruction was an undersea landslide triggered by the Anak Krakatau volcano. Now, scientists believe the threat posed by this volcano could be greater than first thought. The details from our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
The western flank of Anak Krakatau catastrophically failed during an eruption, sending a mass of rock tumbling into the sea. Within 30 minutes, waves, some 3 metres high, had rushed ashore in Java and Sumatra. Scientists from the UK's Hull University have conducted a detailed analysis of satellite pictures of the volcano before, during and after its collapse. Their assessment finds the volume of material that fell into the water totaled 100 million cubic metres. This challenges the existing models used to describe these kinds of events. They suggest 3 times this amount of debris should be needed to produce December's disaster. The Hull team say their work argues now for the hazard preparedness at other volcanoes to be reviewed. There are about 40 volcanoes worldwide thought capable of doing what Anak Krakatau did.
Jonathan Amos. And still to come on the podcast, why cancer deaths in richer countries are on the rise. After battering the Bahamas for a whole day, Hurricane Dorian has finally begun to move on, heading towards the US East Coast. The full scale of the damage in the Bahamas is not yet known. So far, reports say at least 5 people died. The hurricane, one of the most powerful on record, triggered a huge storm surge as well as powerful winds. A hospital in Freeport on Grand Bahama is full of water, with patients in wheelchairs stranded in flooded corridors. Kimberly is a resident of Freeport and spent the day trapped in a house with 12 people.
It's basically sea on land. The storm is so big, it brought the sea on land. The police, they are underwater. We have no emergency personnel. The ambulance is underwater. The fire trucks are underwater. Nobody can get out. Nobody can get in. It's to the point where civilians are now hopping on jet skis trying to save people. And they can only do it, of course, during daylight. Nothing can be done at night. But now you have an issue of people who are suffering possibly from hypothermia. They've been in wet clothes for hours. You have sick people who, for instance, we have what we call a special needs shelter that's been compromised. So when you have shelters which are compromised and you're emergency personnel, you know, the help needs help. You're in a predicament where, you know, you have to have outside folks come and help. Thankfully, we have the U.S. Coast Guard that's helping us out in a time like this. But otherwise, you know, we would be done for.
Kimberly, a resident of Freeport. The Red Cross Deputy Director for the Americas, Steve McAndrew, said Dorian was particularly damaging because it travelled at such a slow pace across the Bahamas.
We have been doing these operations for many years. My first operation was 20 years ago, a hurricane in the Caribbean, and I don't ever recall a hurricane being listed as stationary. So this is quite unique. When the storm is stationary, those winds continue going in a circular fashion, but the storm itself does not move on, and it continues to dump large amounts of rain. It's just raining, 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 raining. The only other storm that this kind of reminds us of in the Americas is Hurricane Mitch, which was back in 1998. And Hurricane Mitch was a devastating event.
Well, the latest forecast from the U.S. National Hurricane Center is for Dorian to move dangerously close to the Florida East Coast in the next 24 hours. Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue is there and says residents have been bracing themselves for days.
It could actually make landfall later in the week up in North Carolina. That's the current path, but lots of things can change between now and then. It has weakened a little, but that's not saying much because the winds are still 110 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's something like 175 kilometres an hour. And of course, when it goes over water, there's always a chance that it can strengthen again. What are people doing in Florida?
Well, there's a whole bunch of mandatory evacuation orders along the Florida coast, as you can imagine, right up into Georgia as well and South Carolina. There's some curfews that are in place in some counties that kick in at 6 o'clock in the evening. I've got to say, the roads and the place is not deserted. A lot of buildings, sure, a lot of businesses are boarded up, restaurants, bars near the beach, but there are still people around coming to have a look. There are cars on the road. Not everyone has left is what I think I'm driving at there. And I think that may be something to do with this fear that the authorities have, that there's been a bit of fatigue about the warnings, that Florida, in a sense, has been bracing itself for days for this, and it now looks like it will miss the worst of it, but there are still big dangers from the water and the wind.
Gary O'Donoghue in Daytona Beach in Florida. Chinese anger at events in Hong Kong has already led to the departure of the boss of the airline Cathay Pacific amid controversy over employees supporting the protests. Now, people in mainland China are expressing outrage at some big European football clubs over the actions of their fans in Hong Kong. I heard more from our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
They're accused of two things. One is being political and posting messages in line with the Hong Kong protesters and telling people that they shouldn't be supporting the police, they should be supporting the protesters who are out on the street. And we have to bear in mind that some of these groups have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of followers. So people based in Hong Kong, big spheres for people to discuss football. People who are police officers are being kicked out of these groups. So they feel that they can't actually support their favourite football team because of their politics, basically.
And people in mainland China are unhappy about this.
They're extremely unhappy. In fact, they've started a campaign to show how many teams are actually doing this. So a social media post that's been going viral on Sina Weibo, which is what people use instead of Facebook or Twitter, shows the emblems of a number of different teams. They say there's more than 20. And these include Manchester United, Liverpool Football Club, not just British teams, but also Western teams like Juventus as well. And they're saying that these are the teams that are guilty of having showed their support for protesters in Hong Kong. And the official line on this from mainland China is that the demonstrations that are happening in Hong Kong are violent and they're absolutely opposed to them. So now that football teams are seemingly showing their allegiance on one side, saying that they're in support of the protesters, people are very, very angry about this and they're calling for boycotts of the team or saying that they might actually stop supporting their favourite team.
But presumably the reason they're angry is these comments which are being posted on Facebook pages, and they're being posted by people presumably in Hong Kong rather than these clubs themselves, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. But because some of them are official, people are saying that the administrators have a certain responsibility. I mean, the fact that they've got so many followers, they more or less speak for the team. And because they are official, people are calling for apologies from some of these teams.
And it's worth underlining how big Western football is in China. So if there's a boycott, that could have a big impact on these clubs.
Western football is huge in China. And also because China's been historically not very good at football, people are just not interested in domestic football. They have a big following with overseas teams.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. Researchers say cancer is surpassing cardiovascular diseases such as strokes and heart attacks as the leading cause of death among middle-aged adults in wealthier countries. The study was led by a team from Canada's McMaster University. I spoke to one of its authors, Daryl Leong.
This research was conducted from the PURE study, which is an ongoing prospective study that's recruited over 160,000 middle-aged adults from 21 countries. And some of these are high and some of them are middle and low-income countries. And in all of the countries studied, cardiovascular disease, which includes heart attacks, strokes and heart failure, are the commonest cause of death overall. But we see some important differences between different groups of countries. So in lower income countries, we find that cardiovascular disease is genuinely the most common cause of death. But there's a gradual transition. So when you move to middle income countries, the risk of dying of cancer progressively increases. And then when you come to high income countries, we found that cancer death actually exceeded cardiovascular death.
And what is it about lifestyles in richer and middle-income nations that makes people there more prone to cancer then?
I think it's actually a bittersweet good news story in that the difference in high-income countries, I think, relates largely to the fact that we're very effective at preventing and treating cardiovascular disease. And so people don't necessarily die of their heart attack as they would have 30 or 40 years ago. So as people survive longer and live to be older, they develop other conditions, cancer being obviously the main competitor for cardiovascular disease. To put it bluntly, at this stage, you have to die of something. And if we're preventing and treating cardiovascular disease very well, cancer emerges, I guess, as the major cause of death.
And what needs to be done in lower income countries to treat these kind of diseases better there?
The problems are multifold. One of the areas that we identified in our research, which we found to be important, is the provision and access to healthcare. We looked at factors such as the use of cardiac medications and also hospitalization rates. And we found that the more these healthcare resources were accessed and utilized, the lower the rates of death. So we certainly feel that these are important factors. And if health systems in all countries, but especially lower income countries, could be implemented so that people had better access to care, we feel that would make a substantial difference to the risk of cardiovascular death.
Dr. Daryl Leong. A grand total of 68 languages is spoken in Colombia. In the small northern town of San Basilio de Palenque, it's Palenquero. The town was founded by escaped slaves in the 17th century and is recognised by UNESCO for its unique culture. But residents haven't found it easy to keep their language and traditions alive. Now, local musicians are trying to help revive the language. Victoria Stunt reports from San Basilio de Palenque.
Good morning. I'm from San Basilio de Palenque, says Andres Padilla Julio in Palenquero, the native language in the town 50 kilometers from Colombia's Caribbean coast. Andres is the leader of the rap group Combi La Salmi, which performs in Palenquero. Part of the group's mission, to use language, African instruments, and stories about San Basilio de Palenque to help preserve the town's traditions.
San Basilio de Palenque is declared a UNESCO Heritage Site for maintaining its music, language, orality, religion, gastronomy. With music, we want it to be maintained, to be shared, and that kids learned about it.
Several times a week, Combi La Salmi organizes free workshops for kids in the town on parranquero, music, dance, and traditional hairstyles. Tonight, it's music and dance. about 50 kids aged 2 to 12 are taking turns dancing in a circle drawn in the street to percussion instruments called el tambor alegre, llamador, maraca, and tambora. Palenquero is a mix of Spanish and Bantu languages spoken in Africa. But today in the town, more people speak Spanish than palenquero. People in San Basilio de Palenque have been discriminated against for speaking the language, says Andres.
When people hear palenqueros speak, to them it's poorly spoken Spanish because they don't understand it. But that's wrong. And because of that, many people stopped speaking palenquero when they left. A father or mother will say, "Don't speak the language," so they don't make fun of you.
But since the 80s in the town, there has been a push by residents to educate people about their ethnic roots. The palenquero language began to be taught in the local school, and in 2010, the Native Languages Law passed in Colombia to protect languages like palenquero.
A report from Colombia by Victoria Stunt. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
With the Capital One Saver Card, you can earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment. That means 4% on checking out that new French restaurant and 4% on bowling with your friends. You'll also earn 2% cash back at grocery stores and 1% on all other purchases. Now when you go out, you cash in. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Terms apply.